人为什么如何自杀，你多挖掘那书他多写一句话，我们是很多他们怎么可以在你当时来说是很讨厌，我为什么我才不写一句话，所以过去的台历是我老婆写的，我没理他说的你要给他一个什么感觉，是你他写的
Hello. Thank you for inviting me here today. It's a pleasure to be here. I think we need to turn on the mics.
Thank you.
Thank you for welcoming me here to Riyadh. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor to be able to address you today. I'd like to take some time today to talk about the design elements and personal learning environments. This is work that we're doing at the National Research Council of Canada. And the intent of this work is to create what we call a learning and performance support system in order to support individual and personal learning in the workplace and beyond. The context of our work is to address skills shortages. And this is something that can be seen from both an industrial perspective as well as from an individual perspective. The industrial perspective is the amount of money lost in high-tech and high-skilled industries because of the lack of qualified people able to do the work. We've estimated, for example, that the Canadian oil and gas sector loses about $4 billion a year due to skill shortages. This is a combination of not having people on the job, of having unqualified people on the job causing accidents, and not being able to effectively plan to maximize revenues. It also affects wages in this sector and in other sectors. In Canada, the unemployment rate for skilled and professional staff is less than 1%. This is very good for these employees. However, it makes it very difficult for staff to fill positions. And this is something that we've actually felt at the National Research Council of Canada, attempting to staff our own positions. And of course, training on the job, or as it generally happens, off the job, can be time-consuming and expensive. Typically what happens is we fly staff to Houston or Dallas or something like that for 3 or 4 days at a cost of $5,000, $10,000 or whatever. From the individual perspective, the skill shortage is matched by an inability to obtain work as a professional or technical employee because of the lack of skills and the lack of opportunity to train or develop skills and education. Individuals, especially in Canada, we have a very widely dispersed population, a large rural population. The opportunity is not always there to be able to achieve these advanced skills and professional certifications. So what we proposed at the National Research Council of Canada is personal learning and performance support, which provides a single point of access to all skills, development, and training needs. Now, this is not a portal. This is not yet another website with a whole bunch of course listings or something like that. The better analogy to think of it is like your own personal wallet or your own personal carry-on, where you keep all of your personal information, all of your access to resources in one place. And this individual learning application creates a personal learning path for you that creates context-aware support. And what that means is support for your learning and development needs that is aware of the environment in which you're working. searchable and verifiable learning resources, something that's always available, like your wallet. And so it's giving you performance support at the point of need. So what does it take to build something like this? Well, in the first instance, it takes something like Canada's National Research Council, because a project like this entails high risk. It is arguably disruptive of the traditional learning technology environment, since it postulates a personal device rather than a learning management system or a content management system. It needs a deep background in e-learning and the e-learning industries, and I'll talk a bit about the work that we've done at National Research Council to develop this expertise. And it needs the capacity to be connected to many companies, many providers, many institutions, because the key aspect of a personal learning environment isn't staging of courses or production of content, it's connecting to many different providers around the world. So it needs an organization and staff in that organization who are able to reach out and meet with and connect with all of these different enterprises. So the National Research Council, and I won't belabor this, has a long history of working in e-learning and e-learning technologies. And I've been there for a large part of it, as have my colleagues. We worked on something called the EduSource Resource Repository Network in the early 2000s, which set up a network of learning repositories across Canada. We did this in conjunction with six partners, including Athabasca University, including Canary, which is our national fiber backbone network, a number of different companies, college associations, etc. We built something called Sifter Filter, which is a collaborative recommendation system. And we did this originally for e-learning materials for a company called Mosaic, but then we commercialized this technology to recommend music. We built something called Share. Share is an automated sentiment analysis tool, so we can look at content and determine the sentiment behind the content. Is it angry? Is it happy? Is it pleased? Is it troubled? Etc. With the major e-learning company Desire to Learn, also located in Canada, we built a collaborative workflow authoring tool that we called Synergique. And if you're working with Desire to Learn today, some of the technology inside Desire to Learn is technology that we designed. We developed the world's first MOOC, which stands for Massive Open Online Course. And we developed the technology behind the MOOC, an application called Grasshopper, which aggregates contents from multiple sources around the world, brings it together, organizes it, sorts it, filters it, sifts it, and distributes it back to the participants in a massive open online course. And this is related to the theory of connectivism, which we are all also co-developers of. And then finally, even here in Riyadh, there is an installation of National Research Council's 2SIM haptic simulation system, which is a medical simulator. It's used to practice doing things like neurosurgery or repairs on bodily injuries and things like that. And it's haptic, which means that if you apply real-world instruments in the simulations, you actually feel, you get the same feel that you would if you were doing real-life neurosurgery or real-life surgery on a flesh wound or something like that. So we have deep experience in the field. Now, Canada has a rich learning and technology marketplace. LPSS, Learning and Performance Support Systems, touches all aspects of that. We go from, we go from content to management systems to the distribution of learning resources to the actual users. And our work impacts on all four of those major sectors of the learning technology marketplace. But most of all, I think it impacts and possibly disrupts the management system area. And that's where we're targeting most of our efforts. If you are working in learning management systems, you will probably be impacted by the work that we are doing. That is our hope, anyways. And this is kind of what it looks like. It looks a bit like a mess, and that's okay. What you're seeing there is a diagram from the first massive open online course that we offered. It was called Connectivism and Connected Knowledge 2008. And I put up this diagram so that you understand that the way we view the structure and organization of learning and of learning resources is fundamentally different from the traditional way of organizing a course or a program. What we set up there is a network of interconnected resources and interconnected people. And the reason why we do it that way, and I'll talk about this during this presentation, is in order to obtain some of the benefits of being structured as a network. It's important to understand that we no longer live in a world of freestanding applications where you have the one application and that's it. Today, we live in a world of interconnected applications. You sometimes hear the phrase API, stands for Application Programming Interface. And that's the mechanism by one application connects to another application. And it's this reality that we're addressing with this new type of design for online learning resources. Here's another representation of our massive open online course. This one was created by a student in the course. It has all the same elements, but of course the perspective and the point of view is a bit different, and so they've drawn a cow. But again, you get the idea. You're connecting Twitter and Facebook and Illuminate and Grasshopper and back channels and USB sockets, etc., etc. MOOC stands for Massive Open Online Course. And it's important to reflect for a few moments on what those terms mean, because they're really at the core of a lot of the work that we're doing in personal learning environments. I see my video recording is failing. I don't know why. That's too bad. At least the audio recording is still working. So, couldn't start the video either. Okay. Oh, I see. All right. So, massive doesn't just mean we have a whole bunch of people, because, you know, a television station has a whole bunch of people, but it's not a massive open online course. Massive means by design. Massive means, well, not scalability in the sense that your application gets bigger and bigger, but massive in the sense that we've created the network in such a way that it can continually expand by creating new connections. Open means open. People can access the materials, they can use the materials, reuse the materials, share the materials. These are all important aspects of an open online course. Again, and I'm going to keep coming back to this point, a MOOC is a web, not a website. There's nothing that can be done to fix that. It's broken. It can't be fixed. Thank you. A MOOC is not a single service that you access. Now, I know that, you know, people like Stanford and MIT and all of the rest of them built things that they called MOOCs. But what they really did is they built a single website. They put some videos on it, and they invited a whole bunch of people. Which is nice, and that works, and it opens stuff up for people. But what's more significant here is the approach where you don't just build one thing and invite the whole world to watch, but rather you build something and then you invite the whole world to keep building it, to keep adding on to it, to keep interacting and connecting. And that's the structure here. Our view of learning and of courses is there may be something at the center there which is an institutional service, but mostly you have individuals connecting with each other in a web of resources. What are the design principles for this web? The design principles are those design principles that foster the most effective functioning of a network. So that forces us to ask, what does a network do? A network, again, is a series of connections between users or between resources or between services or between applications. And the way a network learns is new connections are formed and old connections are dropped. Or maybe connections are strengthened and connections are weakened. As long as the network can keep shifting and reshaping itself according to events that happen, according to experiences that people have, the network can continue to learn. If the network is not able to communicate, if the network is not able to reshift and reorganize itself, then it suffers what we might call network death. The human brain works that way. The human brain is a network of connected neurons. When we learn, we form new connections between the neurons. Quite literally, a connection actually grows from one neuron to another neuron. This is a phenomenon known as plasticity. If the human mind, if the neurons in the human mind are not able to send signals, and if the neurons in the human mind are not able to form new connections, then the human mind can no longer grow. And indeed, if there are no more signals from one neuron to another, that is death. So to promote a network is to promote life. The same principles that promote the network are those that promote life. So what are those principles? Autonomy, openness, diversity, and interactivity. Autonomy. What that means is each neuron functions on its own. In a network, each device functions on its own. So the loss of one entity, of one individual, of one neuron, does not destroy or impair the network. Openness. That means that there is a possibility of communication from one neuron to the next neuron, from one entity to the next entity, from one application to the next application. Networks that foster openness are able to communicate more effectively, are able to react and grow more effectively. Diversity. There are about 100 billion neurons in the human brain, but they're not all the same. There are 10,000 different types of neurons in the human brain, and each neuron, each single neuron in the brain has a unique set of connections to other neurons. So every neuron in the human brain is in some way different. This is important because each one of these neurons, if you will, has its own perspective of the world. In a social network, each individual person has their own perspective, their own way of seeing the world. All of you are sitting in the room, you're all looking at me, but you're each seeing a slightly different version of me because you're looking at me from a slightly different angle. And if people were to ask you later on to describe what you saw, none of you would have the authoritative view of what you saw. You would have to get together and talk about what you saw. And a composite picture would emerge. And that relates to the fourth criterion. Knowledge is created by interactivity. Knowledge is not created by one person saying, my perspective is the main perspective and I'll distribute it to everyone else. Knowledge is created by each person sharing their individual perspective. Even the people way down there, even the people way in the back of the room, everybody has a different perspective. Put them together through interactivity, and that's what produces knowledge. So these are the design principles. And what that means is, when we pick network technologies, when we design network technologies, what we are attempting to do is create a collection of resources that can interconnect according to these principles. So we applied this when we created the first Massive Open Online course, and then we did a number of courses following. We offered CCK08, the Connectivism and Connective Knowledge course, and we offered this another 3 times. And we also offered We also offered courses called Personal Learning Environments, Networks, and Knowledge. We offered this course. It was called Plank. I blame George Siemens for that title. And we offered a course, a 30-week course called Change. And then in collaboration with Desire to Learn and EduCause, and the Chronicle of Higher Education, we offered a course on the future of higher education. And all of these applied the same principle. And we've learned a bunch of lessons about offering this kind of learning and the kind of support that is needed to help people continue this kind of learning. And our biggest challenge always was, the pull between the centralized institutional model and the distributed model, the network model that we were trying to present. I talked earlier about Stanford and MIT and the rest of them creating MOOCs. They created MOOCs that were focused on content, and you see some of their logos on the far right. Coursera, the Stanford Artificial Intelligence course, MIT's edX course. These are all sites that are focused around content. Now you can see that that's almost exactly the opposite of what we designed. We designed networks where content is not the objective of learning, but rather is the signal that is sent from one person to the next. We use content as a means of communication. They use content as something that is transferred from an expert to a passive receiver. There's kind of a middle ground as well, a MOOC focused on tasks and doing things, and I like that model a lot as well. And that model is instantiated by DS-106, that's Distributed Storytelling 106, and it's offered by people like Jim Grimm, Alan Levine, and others at New York University of Mary Washington. So again, all of these MOOCs employed the same design principle. All the MOOCs that we designed employed the design principle of autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity. And as I said, to underline and underscore, these are the principles of effective networks. These are the principles that underlie the effective learning, cognition, and knowledge of a network-based system like the human brain. So how does that work? Well, the next part of what we are trying to do is to create what we might call the pedagogy of the moment. In other words, to approach head-on the question of how you use a MOOC in order to learn. Because it's one thing to say, okay, well, I'm in this network, I'm connected to a bunch of people, but of course the learning does not magically happen when you're in that environment. So we look at a network, we look at a human brain, we look at other kinds of networks, and we ask, what do individuals situated in a network do in order to learn? Well, you'll see this model. You'll actually see this model replicated over and over and over, even in more traditional pedagogical and educational literature. So this is just one version of the model. It's not unique to us at all, but it's the way we've formulated it. Aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. And this is essentially the process of functioning in a network. Aggregate, to bring content in, to link to other resources, to link to the rest of the world and bring experience in. Then remix, to join experiences from two different places together. And you'll find if you look at the literature of creativity, a lot of creativity is based on this principle, where you take the experiences from one domain, maybe psychology, and the experiences from another domain, maybe photography, and you bring them together. And you find similarities, patterns, regularities in this new combined form. And then the next step is you make this your own. You localize it, you manipulate it, you translate it to your own language, you apply it to your own concrete situation. In other words, you repurpose the newly combined resource that you've just created for your own application. You create something. You create something new. And then what we've discovered is a very important part of this process is you share it. You feed it forward. You send what you've created on to the next person. Not for them to memorize. There's no memorizing. But for them to take in and use and manipulate for themselves. And picture now this set of connections between all these individual people, and they're receiving something, working with it, shaping it, sending it on. Receiving something, working with it, shaping it, sending it on. And everybody's doing that. And you're all connected together. And that thing as a whole creates knowledge. And that's how learning happens. So, we started with the massive open online course. We started with the provision of a course and some of the supports for that online. But now we do a very bit of a slow sidestep and a shuffle, if you will. And we're going to look at this course from a bit of a different perspective. We're going to look at it not so much from the perspective or point of view of the institution. We're going to shift our gaze and start thinking about it from the perspective or point of view of the individual. So what we have here, and this is a diagram from Michelle Martin, is a personal learning environment. You've got three people connected, and those are the people that are circled there. And then they are also connected to a whole series of other resources. So that's a picture, a snapshot of a small portion of a MOOC, small portion of one of the online courses that we've offered. And so you can see, even looking at this, the perspective of each of these three people is very different. They're looking at different resources. They're connected to different online discussions and different online applications. The only thing that they have in common is they're connected to each other, but they're not even connected directly to each other. There's generally an intermediary of some sort, although two of them are directly connected, the third not so much. So that's a typical picture, but it's kind of a hard view to have. It's kind of hard to conceptualize in our own mind. But let's look at what's kind of happening at a very simple level behind the scenes. This is the pedagogy that I talked about inside the network environment that I talked about. So one student, one person, creates a resource through that process I described, and they send it to the course. Or, in our case, more accurately, the course comes to them and gets it and retrieves it. Then a second person out there sees a reference to the resource in the course. And that creates the connection via the course between the first and the second person. The second person sees the reference and then asks the first person directly, please give me the resource. And they get the resource. And then a third person is able to see the interaction between the first person and the second person, and they find the reference to the resource. It's this kind of interaction, this kind of support that is needed on multiple occasions, over and over and over again. If you can create the mechanism that supports this kind of sharing and connecting interaction, that is the mechanism you need in order to create a network-based online course. Let me just pause for a second. Pause to allow that to sink in a wee bit. Think about how different this is from a traditional course, right? In a traditional course, what we are concerned about is presenting some content and having people remember it. And everything is geared around that. In our course, what we are concerned about is creating connections and supporting the flow of resources. And everything is geared around that. Our very approach to learning is fundamentally different, but it's also fundamentally more accurate because it is in this way, rather than looking at things and remembering, it is in this way that people actually learn. So let's look at this just for a second from the perspective of the course provider. If you are an academic institution, this is you. This is what you see out there in the world. So there you are with your website, and coming into your website on the upper left is all kinds of student content from WordPress, from YouTube, from Delicious, from Flickr, all the different applications that students use. They use these applications, they create content, it comes flowing into your course, a tidal wave of student creativity. As well, you may create course content yourself. And the way we recommend to teachers in this kind of environment is act like you're a student and go out and find resources and maybe make some resources, aggregate, remix, repurpose, and then feed it into the course. The site takes all of these resources in, remixes them, and then sends it all out to all of the people in the course. And we used a daily newsletter to do that. We used an RSS feed to do that. We used the website to do that. Many different ways. Twitter, etc. And then as well, from the course provider perspective, you might have live online events like this event that we're at here, and recordings of these events, and I hope there's a recording, and these recordings also feed in to the course and then get sent out to all the subscribers. So when you're a course provider, you're very much in the position where you're bringing resources together, reorganizing them, sending them out. Bringing them together, reorganizing them, sending them out. You're not in the business of content production anymore. You're in the business of organizing a learning and technology interaction support network. It's a totally different business. From the perspective of the student, however, it looks completely different. The student is at the center, because that's where they always are. Any person, they are at the center. There's no other place they can be. And the student looks out at the course, and what they see is other people. Their friends, their colleagues, people around the world who are also taking the course. And through these other people, they're seeing blog posts on WordPress, photos on Flickr, videos on YouTube, maybe some course content, maybe a TED talk, maybe an application, maybe a simulation environment, all kinds of resources. This is the student-centered approach to learning design. The idea of this design is based on putting the learner at the center of the course. Here are a couple of diagrams from a few years back. This is Scott Wilson's on the left, Tim Hands on the right. And in both cases, the model is the same. Student at the center, a whole network of resources around them. Here's a simplified design now of the underlying technology needed to make this kind of environment work. And the orange around the outside of the box, those are external resources, external repositories, external applications, external cloud storage, external graph. And what that means is analytics and analysis services. Inside the application that delivers personal support, we have a resource repository network that gathers content in. We have a personal cloud, which is a place for us to store our own resources. We have a personal learning record, which is all of our grades, all of our certifications, all of our credentials, all of our learning activities, all placed in one single location, and importantly, private and secure and belonging to us. This is very important. This is not Facebook. We don't give all of our information away. In a personal learning application, our information belongs to us. Here's another way of looking at the same thing. This is the design of the LPSS system that we're building at National Research Council. And again, the Learning Services Network and Marketplace, Automated Skills Development and Recognition. This is a set of tools and analytics that are available through APIs that help build a recommender capacity inside our application so that our application can use the knowledge from all of the interactions to help us choose our courses and our applications. Our personal credentials and our networks, and a personal learning assistant that helps us view, update, and access training and learning and development resources. Here's another way of looking at our program. The core technologies are the boxes in blue. These are united by what we call a common platform. And that what that does is it specifies the data, the underlying graph data structure that is used to facilitate communication among the different nodes and used to provide interaction between the individual and the rest of the world. This is important because right now it's very difficult for a single person to manage all of their different accounts, all of their different applications that they use, all of the data that they have in many places. So what we have is a common platform that does all of this work for us. So it's like giving us our personal view of many different web applications and services. This is the organization of our research program. And as you can see, we're going from the value proposition, which is to the right, the value proposition of eliminating the skill shortage and providing access to learning for individuals, working back through that, through the different organization and deliverables, to the elements of our program, things like the common framework, the personal cloud, and the resource repository network. Here's another way of looking at the LPSS program organization, and to make it clear here that our program is intended to deliver not just technology, but also an understanding of what's involved in working in this kind of environment, working in this kind of personally centered network environment. And this is important, and this, I know this diagram looks like a mess, but again, when you're working in a real world industrial application, this is the norm. A real world company isn't all nice, neat rows and boxes. We'd like it to be, and the organization chart makes it look that way. But we all know, working in a real company, there are all kinds of interactions and communications. And what we found is that this mechanism for learning in a network is also an effective mechanism for working in a network. And so inside an organizational structure, we insert the different components of LPSS. So I could go on, I could talk, and I don't really have time to continue in a great deal of detail, but we have the personal learning assistant as the actual front end. I sometimes talk about it as the pointy end of LPSS, because this is the part of the application that a person works with. And it displays resources, it provides interaction, it provides access to remote services like simulations, training environments, and the rest of it. Here's another way of looking at the same five core applications with the personal learning record at the center. Oh, all the controls are in Arabic. So I have a bunch more slides talking about the individual details of each of these. I'm not going to be able to present each of the individual detailed slides. These slides, however, are available on my website, and therefore you'll be able to access them and look at exactly how we plan to do things like resource repository network and the rest of it. There's the personal cloud to organize your storage systems, maintain encryption so that your data remains private and personal. Projection of learning services into multiple platforms. We don't want learning just to be something that's on your computer. We want learning to be something that's in your car, in your workplace, in your tools and appliances themselves. And that's the job of the personal learning assistant, which also collects information about your interaction with these services, connecting to real world and workplace environments. Analytics as a service. Just in the same way you can connect to an external translation service, you can connect to an external analytics service. The personal learning record, which is data owned by you and shared only with your permission. The full record of interactions, data exchange, your personal portfolio, your certificates, and your credentials. So we have a number of separate projects that together combined to form LPSS. We did a project with the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie. We did some work with Alexa. We did some work with the Privy Council Office in Canada on badges. We've done a project for a large aviation company. The project was called TSAW. There's the Two Sim Simulator and a number of other projects and programs. And the idea, ultimately, is to support the individual working and living in a network. And if you work and live in a network environment, if you work and live in a complex technological environment, this is the way your learning, your training, your development, and your knowledge will be shaped in the future. So we've launched an early pre-alpha version of the application. Very simple version of the application. It's at lpss.me. And you can see that now if you go to that site, lpss.me, you can see the very beginnings of the system.
Carefully.
You want me to shut up now? Okay.
Thank you so much.
I had one slide to go. He stops me. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. All right, you want me to move now? Oh, yeah, right. Complete MOOCs in particular is because the MOOC is set up in such a way as to allow people to sample at very low risk and very low investment the course and its contents. And if they decide that the course and the contents are not suitable to them, they're able to leave without penalty. And this is not a bad thing, this is a good thing. Right? Because we're now enabling people to choose all and only the education that is directly relevant to them. And we're doing it in a way that makes it really easy for them to look at something and go away. Look at something and go away. So I think the way to evaluate a MOOC and the completion rates in a MOOC is not by the number of people who decide they do not want to take that MOOC or they do not want to finish that MOOC, but rather to look at the number of people that the MOOC successfully serves. I'll say one other thing too. We assume, I think incorrectly, that the reason anyone would take a course is to go through it to completion. We assume people want to finish courses, and if they did not finish the course, that is somehow a failure. But I think that this assumption is mistaken. People access a course, even in a traditional institution, for many reasons. Now, in a traditional institution, they're forced to finish the course, or there'll be penalties. And so they're forced to do things that they really didn't want to do, and had no desire to do, but it was the only way to get the information. In the online world of open education, a person can go into a course, look at the course, talk to some of the people, and get an impression of what that subject is like And that's all they wanted. And so they're done, even though the course is not done. Yeah, I think that's a good point. That sort of organization cannot simply be inserted as a substitute for traditional education. A MOOC is, and especially the way we've designed the MOOC, in the end becomes very much about students organizing their own learning for themselves and organizing their own discussions and organizing their own groups. And it's interesting because a MOOC is almost going back to the traditional form of higher education that existed before we had standardized classes and standardized courses and standardized tests. The traditional kind of learning that characterized Oxford and Cambridge and other universities, where the students themselves would form themselves into associations and manage their own learning and access the professors as mentors and lecturers and resources as needed. And I think that over time, what we will see is a gradual increase in student organized learning in this way and a gradual transition of the traditional university away from offering standardized courses and more toward offering specialized support, resources, mentoring, and the occasional lecture.
Yeah, I'm also a mentor of our team, so it's going to be enhancing for the consistency.